Hey guys, I just wanted to make a really quick announcement. We have launched our brand new Instagram account called The Fix. We'll be sharing all our updates here, including new podcast episodes, articles, research, and other exciting projects that we've got coming up. So please follow our new account on Instagram and also sign up to our weekly newsletter called The Fix at michellepking.com/thefix. I also just want to say a really big thank you to all of you for your support. And now let's get started with today's episode. Have you ever wondered what a gender-equal world would actually look like? Well, let's fast forward to 2069 and imagine for a moment that gender equality is the norm. Women are advancing in corporations at the same rate as men, and women hold just as many powerful positions as men. What would it be like to work in this workplace? And more importantly, what would it take for us to achieve this? I'm Michelle King, and you're listening to She Innovates. It's a show that shares the stories, challenges, and triumphs of women and men across innovation, technology, and entrepreneurship. Most of us tackling some of the world's most pressing problems today often just focus on the underlying issues in an attempt to try and identify the most appropriate solution. Very rarely do we just sit back and imagine what the future could look like. A few months ago, The Economist published a fascinating article entitled, If 50% of the CEOs are Women, Generation XX, January 2069. This article imagines a world where gender equality is the norm. Sasha Nauta, public policy editor for The Economist, is going to be joining us today on the podcast to explore this world. And throughout the show, we are going to try and answer the number one question. What got us to a gender-equal future?
We run this series called The World If, and it's a really good thought experiment, I think, because it forces you to A, paint that picture of that world, but B, to really challenge yourself of, okay, how do we actually get there? And I think I was quite keen to do it with this topic because, you know, we talk about gender equality and the need to get there all the time, but we don't really talk enough, I think, about really breaking down the different steps, working backwards from that world. You know, we tend to only focus on the next step. So I took the goal of 50% of CEOs being women, not because I literally think that's the world I picture where one in two CEOs is a woman and we're in a happy place. It's more that that should be a symptom, right, of the system that's changed enough that that's possible. It's very simple, actually. It's just where a female graduate and a male graduate both start at the same firm and they both have the same opportunities to make it all the way to the top. Doesn't mean they both will, but it just means that there's no extra obstacles for the female compared to the male to get there. So it's a workplace where both men and women have equal chances and opportunities, whether that's related to pay or promotion or ultimately access to power. It's really just a better optimization of talent.
Sasha's description of a gender-equal world is really the aim of all our efforts. Workplace gender equality is achieved when people are able to access and enjoy the same rewards, resources, and opportunities regardless of their gender. So how do we get there? Well, The Economist article touches on a number of avenues to create a gender-equal business. And here's Sasha sharing the key things that companies should focus on.
I think you want to start with identifying the obstacles in your company, in your workplace, because they are not the same. I mean, we did a gender pay audit here in Britain last year, mandatory, and it showed that, you know, different types of companies have got hugely different problems. So I'd start with the absolute basics, which is, do a gender audit where you do anonymous staff surveys to find out what is actually stopping staff from progressing or simply what is bothering them, and dig into the data. Simple metrics like attrition rates, when are you losing women? Why are you losing them? Did anybody ask them why they were leaving, rather than just assuming, particularly when women have children, you know, that they want to opt out? Actually, did anybody ask them whether there was a way of keeping them? Another really useful metric is stagnation. You can tie this to the gender pay gap, right? At what point do women in your organization start to become a minority? What is it about that step in progression that's making them drop off? And then secondly, the big thing, the single big thing, I think, is looking at how you promote and how you assign projects. So promotion, we all think it's done on equal terms, but very often it's not. You know, how you phrase your criteria, simply what criteria you set for promotion can make a huge difference, right? And we know that women do particularly well when it's quantifiable, whereas men do particularly well when it's super subjective. So if you don't have any criteria for who should next become a manager, then it's much more likely to become a guy, because we just know that the subjective tends to push in that direction. Whereas when you have a very clear list of here are the five things you need to have achieved to be considered a manager, then you have a much more equal playing field where women can take part on equal terms as well. And then very, very briefly, I mentioned the assigning of projects. I think that sounds really small, but it's huge. We know that sometimes young mothers, for example, are given a break, in inverted commas, by not being asked to come on a trip or not being given another client. You're trying to think for them, but you're in fact disadvantaging them. So yeah, looking very carefully at how you assign and how you promote, and just being very honest about how you do that, I think is important. And then the final one I would point to is don't ignore parenthood. I think a lot of employers will sort of think that they're doing all the basics on parenthood by not discriminating openly against new mothers. But we just know that motherhood is one of the harshest moments in women's careers. And it doesn't need to be, because, again, it doesn't need to be a drop-off moment. All the obvious stuff like affordable childcare and parental leave for both sexes, and just not making that very basic error, which unfortunately is still, I think, really implicit, that you see the decision to have a child as a sign of a lack of commitment to the job by a woman, which I can't believe in 2018 I still have to say that, but it's still implicit in a lot of corporate cultures.
One of the key solutions put forward today to advance women is quotas. Now, I'm not a fan of quotas. In fact, I think they can often create the unintended consequences of tokenism, backlash, or solutions that focus on fixing women. The logic of quotas is that they create a trickle-down effect, but this very rarely happens. In fact, recent research has even highlighted that women on boards or in CEO positions who leave their roles are very rarely replaced with another woman.
For me, intuitively, it's not the solution at all. In fact, it could make matters worse. Yes, on paper, it can make matters better, as in you will have more women in whatever position you've mandated. But whether you fix anything, I'm very unsure. And particularly here in Europe, we've had some government-mandated quotas, particularly in Scandinavia. And you're seeing what I'm a little bit afraid of, which is firstly, not the trickle-down effect that some would hope for. Because the argument is often sort of, we'll have this temporary quota because we have to kickstart things because things aren't going to fix themselves, which is, you know, fair point, things aren't going to fix themselves. But so we'll have a quota for, you know, 5 or 10 years, and then you'll see a trickle-down effect, and then we won't need quotas anymore and it'll all be fine. And so far, the evidence just doesn't bear that out. Like, people who say that the Norwegian quotas work, if you dig into it, what works is that you now have, I can't remember the figure, but 40% or whatever of boards are women. Yet that bit worked because that bit was mandated. But if you look at senior women roles and sort of all the levels that you would want to see more women appear as well, that's not actually happening. So my first issue is just, I'm not sure it works. But secondly, as a woman who would like to, by my own merit, rise in the organization I work in, I'm terrified of the arguments around tokenism, which I think are actually sometimes fair. I don't personally want to get to a position where people will say, well, you know, you were helped by the quotas. There are much better reasons and ways that we women could make it to the top. on our own merits, and I genuinely believe, I don't know whether it will be 2069, I hope it will, but that we can get to that world, and there won't be an argument about, oh, but did they cheat? You know, did they cheat their way there? Targets is a slightly different thing. So targets are non-binding, right? So it's just to say, it would be nice if. And if we sort of go back to what I was saying earlier, you know, hot jobs, particular jobs of which we just know these are really important pivot points, or this is a really good way of making sure you can make that next jump into your career. So take, for example, journalism, right? Where I'm sitting, it really helps to edit at some point. If you work in a whatever consultancy, again, you know, working with clients is that really obvious thing when you can really make a big jump in your career. There, you could say as an employer, as a company, okay, we know of a few particular, either depending on what your workplace structure is, you know, either levels of jobs or groups of jobs where women are hugely underrepresented, and we're going to give the managers there a target where we say, you know what, within X years, we think you should aim, or perhaps just annually, you should aim to increase the number of women in your group by Z. And the big difference, it might seem like just semantics, but there is a huge one, is that there's absolutely no obligation on them to get there, but they will be held accountable. So that, you know, at your annual review, it's like, okay, the target was X, you didn't get to X, please explain why. And sometimes there's a really good reason, right? I mean, we didn't get any applications. Well, okay, so let's see why that might be. I'm much more taken by that sort of approach, where at least you all agree on what the aim is, but you're not going to at all costs sort of put token women in those positions.
With the push for corporations to advance women, we often see one initiative after another being implemented. With all this activity, it's very rare that we actually discuss what we need to stop doing. I think we need to be a little bit more open about discussing which initiatives are actually unhelpful for women or damage gender equality efforts. Here, Sasha shares her reflections on what organisations need to stop doing.
So one of the things that a lot of companies have been doing for quite a long time is to foster, facilitate, whatever word you want to use, women-only groups. And the same, by the way, goes for other groups, ethnic minorities, LGBT community. So, you know, you can have your own group and you can talk to each other, and then we've sort of solved the issue. And lo and behold, that doesn't really work. All the women get together. They talk amongst themselves about all the problems they face in the workplace. And it's very understandable. I mean, I do that with female colleagues as well, informally in the pub. But as an actual office initiative, just getting a group together without actually senior leadership buy-in, without actually getting men into the room, etc., we know it doesn't really lead to much beyond just an internal conversation. And I think what's more damaging about it is that the workplace or the employer can say, oh, no, we're, look at how progressive we are. The other, slightly less original but very important, is poor training. Enough research has been done now on bad training. So either where, you know, behavior is totally cartoonish and ridiculous, or where it's so subtle that you have this sort of gotcha moment where you're trying to trick people into showing that they're horrible human beings. We know it doesn't work. It can either just have no effect, or it can actually reinforce biases or behavior. I think the final one is just empty gestures. Again, related to all this Me Too stuff, there's a lot of firms out there that will now say things like, we have zero tolerance for sexual harassment, or we are an equal opportunity employer. And that simply by stating that, they are it. It just really annoys me when companies do that without actually being able to show it. Like, I'd almost rather you don't say it until you actually are it. Because again, going back to sort of the start of this conversation, you know, when you break down the steps, this is not a matter of doing one thing and you're there, or two things. It's something that has to happen all the way across the organization. It is going to take many years. And frankly, anybody who today says they're an equal opportunity employer is probably lying, because very few places genuinely across the board can say that they are there today.
As most organizations are run predominantly by men, it makes sense that we cannot achieve gender equality without engaging men. Sasha says that to reach true equality and to access Pound 2069, we have to involve and encourage men to take action.
So from a corporate perspective, just to start, we do kind of know of the employers, of the businesses that are doing a relatively good job, one thing they have in common is that really at the top, CEO and basically, you know, the C-suite and senior leaders are really buying this, or at least they're walking the talk. You know, they're going to the meetings, to the groups, they're sitting in the front row, they're taking part in these conversations rather than just signing off on them. So I think, you know, that might sound a little bit, not even pinkwashy, but that might sound a bit symbolic. Symbols aren't enough, but they do matter. So I think having the very top show that this is serious, I think sets quite an important example to men further down the ladder. If I can say one thing to women, it's also to be perhaps a bit, not necessarily patient, but just forgiving to men who are trying to get with the program. So that doesn't mean to say if a guy says something that comes across a bit silly or biased or ignorant, that you shouldn't point it out. But sometimes I feel that we kind of shut the conversation down as well. And that men, even men who want to sort of get involved, are terrified of saying the wrong thing or of alienating or of, heaven forbid, insulting anybody. And I don't just mean sort of in relation to Me Too. I think just more generally, the gender equality thing, you know, some of the language around, you know, men just need to shut up and listen. And no, you don't get to have a say because you don't know what it's like to be a woman and just know your place. I personally don't think that's a helpful way of making allies. And as much as we may not like the idea, we need allies across the board to make this kind of change. And when it comes to engaging, you know, particularly senior men in organizations, framing it around, this is not just about doing the right thing, this is also just about making the most of the talent you have under your roof, I think is a more useful way of talking about it than sort of going on the moral crusade.
I often say that gender equality is the future of work, because for companies to advance, they need to foster innovation and creativity. Great minds actually do not think alike. That's precisely what makes them so great. And Sasha and I believe that beyond gender equality, diversity in talent and backgrounds is a critical factor that will determine which companies survive in the emergent era.
We know in general that homogenous groups are just not very good, right? Any group with the same people in it doesn't do as well as a diverse group. And if you're thinking of a world where we do have tech changing the workforce an awful lot, and therefore humans are going to have to prove their added value on top of that, keep coming back to creativity and the importance of innovation and just thinking differently, because that's where we're going to have added value surely over all these wonderful machines. So the thing companies are surely going to worry about the most in the coming couple of decades is just how do I get the best talent in, but how do I get diverse talent, diversity in thought, diversity in background, diversity in experience and in perspective. And that's not just gender. I mean, there's lots of different types of diversity, but gender is a bloody good one to have in there. And I'm pretty convinced by the evidence around, for example, bank boards, where we know that having women on bank boards leads to less risk-taking, which is just undeniably good. Having women on surgeon teams, having women in innovation labs, again, I don't think it's just about women. It is also just about having different people.
There are so many great takeaways from my conversation with Sasha. The key actions I think all of us can start to take is to consider what gender equality might actually look like in our workplace and how we can get there through engaging both men and women. This also means thinking about what we need to stop doing, which can be just as important as the initiatives we decide to take up. Today on Fairy Godboss Insights, we're going to be talking about the best ways to attract and retain top talent. Carla Harris, the Vice Chairman of Wealth Management at Morgan Stanley, shares three things that companies can do to retain top talent and enable them to succeed. These include fostering a workplace where people can bring their whole, authentic selves to work, allowing employees to have a voice in their company and speak up, and having a sponsor, who is an advocate that behind closed doors will support talented individuals to get that promotion. If you're interested to learn more, please check out fairygodboss.com or the article in this week's The Fix newsletter. I really hope you all enjoyed today's episode and the slight change that we did to the format of the show. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I'll catch you all again next week.
She Innovates is produced by Human Group Media, a company that inspires people to do good through the power of audio storytelling. This podcast is made possible by SAP NextGen, an innovation platform that enables everyone, from individuals, companies, partners, and universities, to connect and innovate with purpose. In doing so, SAP NextGen supports the achievement of the Sustainable Development Goals.